WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
It was in 1973 that my guest Tim O'Brien published his first novel about the war in Vietnam. It was called If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home. The story was told by an infantryman who was drafted after graduating college. It seems like a very autobiographical work. Tim O'Brien was born in 1946, a war baby. He served as a foot soldier in Vietnam. In 1974, O'Brien's Northern Lights was published, a novel that's set in Minnesota and is about the relationship of two brothers, one of whom was a Vietnam vet. His most recent novel, Going After Cacciato, was published in 1978. In this novel, a soldier named Cacciato decides to go AWOL in Vietnam and says he plans to walk to Gay Paris. This book won the National Book Award in 1978. He's currently working on a novel called The Nuclear Age. Tim O'Brien is in Philadelphia to give a reading at Temple University, which, by the way, he just finished. He's a guest instructor at Temple University Center City for the course Contemporary Literature, The Writer's View. Tim O'Brien, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Great pleasure to have you here.
It's fun to be here.
Before we talk about your writing, I would like it if you could read for us the opening from your most recently published book, Going After Cacciato.
I will. It begins, "It was a bad time. Billy Boy Watkins was dead, and so was Frenchie Tucker. Billy Boy had died of fright, scared to death on the field of battle, and Frenchie Tucker had been shot through the nose. Bernie Lynn and Lieutenant Sidney Martin had died in tunnels. Pedersen was dead, and Rudy Chasler was dead. Buff was dead. Ready Mix was dead. They were all among the dead. The rain fed fungus that grew in the men's boots and socks, and their socks rotted. And their feet turned white and soft so that the skin could be scraped off with a fingernail. And Stink Harris woke up screaming one night with a leech on his tongue. When it was not raining, a low mist moved across the paddies, blending the elements into a single gray element, and the war was cold and pasty and rotten. Lieutenant Corson, who came to replace Lieutenant Sidney Martin, contracted dysentery. The trip flares were useless, the ammunition corroded, and the foxholes filled with mud and water during the nights. And in the mornings, there was always the next village, and the war was always the same. The monsoons were part of the war. In early September, Vaught caught an infection. He'd been showing Oscar Johnson the sharp edge on his bayonet, drawing it swiftly along his forearm to peel off a layer of mushy skin. Like a Gillette Blue Blade, Vaught had said proudly. There was no blood, but in 2 days the bacteria soaked in, and Vaught's arm turned yellow, so they bundled him up and called in a dust-off, and Vaught left the war. He never came back. Later, they had a letter from him that described Japan as smoky and full of slopes, but in the enclosed snapshot, Vaught looked happy enough, posing with two sightly nurses, a wine bottle rising from between his thighs. It was a shock to learn he'd lost the arm. Soon afterward, Ben Nystrom shot himself through the foot, but he didn't die, and he wrote no letters. These were all things to joke about, the rain, too, and the cold. Oscar Johnson said it made him think of Detroit in the month of May. Luton weather, he liked to say. Luton weather, the dark and gloom, just right for rape and Luton. Then somebody would say that Oscar had a swell imagination for a darkie. That was one of the jokes. There was a joke about Oscar, many jokes about Billy Boy Watkins, the way he died of fright in the field of battle. Another joke was about the lieutenant and his dysentery. And another was about Paul Berlin's purple bile, his fear. There were jokes about the postcard pictures of Christ that Jim Pedersen used to carry, and Stink Harris's ringworm, and the way Buff's helmet filled with life after death when he was shot. Some of the jokes were about Cacciato. "Dumb as a bullet," Stink said. "Cacciato, dumb as a month-old oyster fart," said Harold Murphy. In October, near the end of the month, Cacciato left the war.
Such a great opening for a book. Tim, thanks for reading that for
us. It's fun to do.
It's the opening of Going After Cacciato, which is his most recently published novel, which won a National Book Award in 1978. So many writers, particularly young writers, try to find the great experience to write about, the great story. And if you've lived an ordinary life, you might wonder, where you're going to find the great story. For you, was the war mm-hmm. that great story when you were starting to write?
Yeah, it was. I think if it hadn't been for the war, I would never have been a writer. I'm a believer in fiction having some anchor and substance, that it be about something, which requires a knowledge of the world. I'm not an advocate of young writers running off to fight wars. I am saying, though, that any writer, almost by definition, is someone who pays very close attention to the events around him and takes advantage of what happens in his or her own life. That's what happened to me. I was drafted in 1968 out of Macalester College. I was an intellectual. I was a student body president. I was interested in politics. The last thing that ever crossed my mind, even though I knew a war was in progress, was that I'd end up fighting in the war, that I'd be a foot soldier. And yet it happened. And having returning from Vietnam, I had a need to write, not just a desire. I had the desire before, the need to write, not just to get things out of me in a cathartic sort of way, but to get things into other people, to put them, to communicate. Here's how it was. Here's what I thought. Here's what I went through. These were the issues that I faced, whether to run away from the war or to go to the war, those sorts of things. I had something to say. Too many young writers, I fear, come to writing for wrong reasons, because it sounds glamorous or because it would be a nifty way to spend one's life. I'm a believer in knowing something, and Vietnam taught me a lot.
We had heard for years that publishers and movie producers didn't think that the American public was ready until the late 70s for any fiction about the Vietnam War, because there was still too many open wounds, mm-hmm. too much anger, too much confusion. Was it hard to get your book in 1973, your first book about the war, published?
No, it wasn't hard, but I was fortunate. You're right that at that time in 71, 2, 3, there seemed to be in this country, on the part not only of publishers, but of movie makers as well, a reluctance, a commercial reluctance to deal with Vietnam, that the track record of Vietnam books was very, very poor. They weren't selling. And publishers are money-making animals. They're in the business for a profit. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to publish. They have to make money, and hence Vietnam was a taboo subject, not just for kind of cultural reasons, but for financial reasons. I was fortunate, though, to find a publisher who the man himself, the publisher, felt it was quite important that my first book be published and was willing to take a financial risk. He did. He made money. The book wasn't a bestseller by any means, but it was nonetheless widely read and worth publishing. Those kinds of publishers were rare then, and they're even more rare today.
I don't know if this is fair or not, but in some ways it seems like Vietnam movies have become a genre in the way that Holocaust movies have. You feel, someone like me who has experienced the Vietnam War and the Holocaust mm-hmm. through films and literature, feels a certain familiarity with it. Like I know what the jungle was like during the war. I know what Auschwitz was like, and I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know how it's been conceived of in movies. Do you think that movies and literature have been useful to us in deciphering what happened and in helping us come to grips with it, or does it just become another genre?
Well, it's the only mode you have. I mean, you're, if you haven't been to war, or if you haven't been in a concentration camp, the only means of understanding what happens in a war in a concentration camp is through some sort of communication, be it movies, be it a friend's anecdote, or a book, or television. And you're absolutely right that a book, a movie, it can't put you in Vietnam physically. It can't put it can't put you in Auschwitz physically. All it can do is through through art, try to render the experience in such a way as that for at least temporarily, while the book is being read or the movie's being watched, a spell is cast. And you feel you're there. The illusion of being there is cast. It's all in writing and doing movies, I suppose, too. You feel like a magician in a sort of way, trying to do tricks, to beguile the reader, to make the reader join your dream. When I wrote Cacciato, when I write any of the stories or books I write, my whole effort as an artist is to somehow dream a dream on paper. And my hope is that if I do it well enough, dream it vividly enough, and make the characters vivid enough, and the plot vivid enough, and the issues important enough, that at some point the reader is going to slip into my dream and dream it right along with me. This sounds quite mystical, but I think that's how it works.
Are there any like key points that you particularly wanted to communicate to your readers about the experience of the
world? Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's wrong, I think, to talk about war genres. We don't speak of love stories as a genre because they're so diverse. There's all kinds of love stories, sad and happy, and I mean all kinds of them, which are dependent on the character. Similarly with war, my book Cacciato was radically different in many, many respects from, say, Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. My concerns aren't Stephen Crane's or Joseph Heller's or Kurt Vonnegut's. They're mine. And I think that Cacciato, or my first book, If I Die, both have a uniqueness. They're me. And that doesn't speak to their value or their virtues, but it does say that they're unique. And yes, there were things I wanted to get across. And Cacciato particularly, the main thrust of that book is this, that a soldier spends most of his life in war and combat being bored, standing guard, looking into the dark, being afraid, but still bored. And most of your time is in a war situation is spent in your head, that you're dreaming. You're making stories up. You're saying, Tim, when this war is over, you're going to go to this hotel room, and you're going to lock yourself in, turn that air conditioner on, get a big vat of Coca-Cola and lie there and drink that cold Coke, no bugs, no mosquitoes, no fear. And you begin imagining it, dreaming it, lying in that hotel room, maybe in the cold tile floor. Now that's how, or else you imagine going back to your family or your girlfriend. You imagine taking trips. And that life of the imagination, that's how soldiers live, dreaming a great deal of the time. But we all live that way in our own lives, you know, that the GM factory worker lives that the way. And so the point of Cacciato, in large part, was to tell a soldier's dream. Here's how this soldier spent his time. He spent his time dreaming about running away, fantasizing, making it up. Boy, I could get across those mountains into Laos, and boy, would that be nice. And then what? Well, then I'd walk over to Thailand, and from there to Paris. And he begins imagining what would happen to him. Could he live with running away? Could he deal with it? Would he be happy? Living in exile, deserting. And that life of the imagination, which is the core of Cacciato, I think is the core of war.
Did you read a lot of literature about World War I or World War II before you were in the Army?
No, I wasn't. I was a philosophy and political science major. I was a young kid when I went to war. I was 21. And my reading was pretty light. I think I may have read The Red Badge of Courage. But that's it, in terms of war writing. And even today, I'm still playing catch-up ball. I read a lot, all the time. I read as much as I can. But I'm way behind a lot of other people that that studied English and were able to take advantage of English courses. So I didn't come to writing any of my books through a really systematic contact with other literature, other war literature.
Someone suggested to me today that the type of war story that succeeds the best is the kind in which, at the end of the book, we learn to see the enemy as someone like ourselves. And of course, All Quiet on the Western Front. Mm-hmm. It just epitomizes that. We're the mm-hmm. Russian and German soldier in the trench together, mm-hmm. and there's such a strong bond, but they're also enemies, and they're aware of both of those things at the same mm-hmm. time. But the same person suggested that this hasn't happened in the Vietnam War, and that somehow the Vietnamese have always been seen in the literature and in the films as being this nightmare other creature, a breed that is so different from us, whose lives are so different, that they're almost creatures of the imagination, and that, mm-hmm. that there isn't that common bond. How do you react to that?
Well, you're right. There was I didn't fight in World War II or anywhere else, just in Vietnam, but I think that there was a pretty substantial difference in the perception of the enemy between and among wars. For example, in Vietnam, one of the questions was, who is the enemy? Who are we fighting? All around the foot soldier in Vietnam are the citizens of Vietnam, the villagers and the peasants. But what's not known is whether or not those citizens, those peasants, those villagers are for us or against us, whether they're the enemy or not. You begin there with that kind of common, I mean, everyone knows that, we've heard that enough. But if you layer that gap with lots of others, for example, the language. We American soldiers spoke not a word of Vietnamese, most of us. The culture, there was utter ignorance of the culture of Vietnam. Whereas if you were fighting in Germany or in France, there was, even if you didn't really understand the German culture or the French culture, there was a feeling that you did, that just that sense of, well, you know, they're not that much different from us. Beyond that, though, the most important single factor, I think, in the American infantryman's relationship to the Vietnamese was the absence of understanding, the absence of knowledge regarding the Vietnamese values. A big part of Cacciato, to me, deals with this really important subject. For example, in Vietnam, which is a Confucian Buddhist society, the land, the physical land, the hedgerows, the paddies, the earth itself, has a great, great religious value. The ancestors are buried there. They become a part of the land. They are the land. And in this sense, the land isn't really, it's a sacred. And when we find ourselves as foot soldiers trampling those paddies, burning huts, wasting the land, we're not just destroying property, as perhaps we would in America. That's bad enough, burning up someone's house, destroying someone's field. But in Vietnam, the sin, the crime, or whatever it is compounded, or was compounded, by the fact that the land, the paddies and so on, had a value that went way beyond mere property, but went to the very heart of what that civilization was all about. And we didn't understand that. We didn't know that. So you can see there's layers of ignorance when we were in Vietnam, the language, the people, who are the friends, who are the enemies, which villages are safe, which aren't. And then the ignorance, the most important ignorance, that being a total ignorance of the Vietnamese value structure. We didn't know it. And we violated it without knowing it.
Does the lack of understanding that comes from that kind of ignorance and inability to communicate one another get translated into racism?
No, I don't think so. There was racism in Vietnam, but most of it wasn't directed toward the Vietnamese. At least in my experience, it was directed soldier to soldier in the American Army. Racism toward blacks and black racism toward whites.
Explain what you mean by that.
I can only do it in an anecdotal form. As here, also in Vietnam, white soldiers and black soldiers lived apart. Even though we were in the same platoons, the same companies or squads, it was very difficult to get close to blacks to whites and whites to blacks. It was very difficult for in my company for blacks to be assigned rear echelon jobs. The one chief kind of permanent goal of any foot soldier is to get sent to the rear, get out of the war, you know, wash the colonel's laundry, sort the mail, whatever you can do, get to that rear. We just dreamed about it all the time. And because the officers were largely white, and because the first sergeants were mostly white, not because of that, that's not really the cause, I suppose, but nonetheless, blacks just didn't get those rear jobs, and they got angry. There was a fragging in my company. A black soldier just so angry at no blacks getting the rear that the first sergeant was fragged as a result of it. That's what I mean by anecdotal. And I'm not saying I don't want to draw big generalizations or anything, but in my experience, which is all I write about really, the racism that I saw was really not directed toward the Vietnamese so much as it was toward soldier to soldier. But look, in any war, there's a wonderful book called The Warriors, which was written by a fellow named J. Glenn Gray. And in it, he talks about images of the enemy in World War II. And he kind of sets up categories of ways that we look at the enemy. We look at them, for example, as animals. We look at them as devils. You know, the Viet Cong could slip through wire. They could fly at night. They could do all these incredible, ghostly, devilish things. We can view the enemy with respect at times. We can view the enemy as crusaders. We can view the enemy as in all kinds of ways. And I think that those categories that J. Glenn Gray writes about in his book, The Warriors, apply equally to Vietnam, that the enemy is viewed differently by different people and in a whole variety of ways. It's not a single way of looking at the enemy. It's very common, you know, everybody writes in the books and does movies where they're called slopes or dinks and so on. That's looked at as a racist sort of thing. But we forget that in World War II, those same kinds of words, the krauts, the nips, the japs, all that sort of junk. It's a way to try to externalize the enemy, to try to make the enemy something you can kill. It's hard to kill a Vietnamese human being. You know, we don't call them, there's a Vietnamese human being shooting at me. You know, it's hard to kill something where you get that close. And so you try as a soldier, you don't try, you just do it, to remove yourself from the enemy a bit by making up these kind of tag words. The same thing, though, applies, again, soldier to soldier. In Vietnam, we didn't call each other very often by name, you know, Fred. We made up nicknames, the Ready Mix, Nestle's Quick, all kind of College Joe, that was my nickname, as a way of separating ourselves just a bit, distancing ourselves just a bit from our comrades. So if someone were killed, it didn't seem quite so personal. You know, a friend didn't die, no, it was just old Ready Mix, got his cream whipped.
The racism that you talk about between blacks and whites in the army, I haven't seen that addressed in any other films or books that I can think of. I wonder if you think that the films, for instance, that have come out about the war in the past few years, if they've come close to addressing the Vietnam experience, if there's any there that you thought were particularly successful.
Yeah, well, how do I say this? I don't think of myself as an expert in war. I was just a lowly PFC private when I came out a sergeant, and I don't think of myself as a soldier or even as a war writer. I'm writing a book now that has nothing to do with war at all, or at least with Vietnam. But as art, clearly some of the movies are much better than others. And to defend or attack the movies, I'd have to get into a whole theory of what I think is good and bad art. Just as a simple kind of blunt statement, I think that the best film about Vietnam in terms of just art was The Deer Hunter. That it seemed to me the best made, had the best structure. The worst, I think, probably is a toss-up between Coming Home and Apocalypse Now as art.
You were talking about the language and how you use word like gooks and Charlie's to just distance the enemy. How did that language rub off in you as a writer? This use of language to distance yourself from your friends and the people you were fighting with, and to distance yourself from your enemy.
You use it the same way. If I were writing a novel, let's say about a feminist rap group, and if my purpose were to explore the issues and values and problems that might be incorporated in that kind of a novel, I would certainly pay close attention to the kind of language that would be used by the people in that group and the differences in the language. I mean, you don't want to build stereotypes, but you want to try to capture the diversity of language. Language is how we communicate. That's how we do it. We use, maybe there's body language too, but most of our communication, or a large part of it anyway, is through language. Maybe not most, but a lot of it is. And you have to pay attention to it. So when I wrote Going After Cacciato, I dredged my memory for how language was used in Vietnam, how soldiers talked, and why they talked as they talked, and then tried to use it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim O'Brien, and he's a novelist. We're talking about his work. His most recent novel is called Going After Cacciato, and his novel in progress is called The Nuclear Age. Did you write when you were there? Did you keep a journal?
I wrote a little. The first big thing I read published was a piece of Cacciato, of If I Die in a Combat Zone, which was published in Playboy just a month or so after I returned from Vietnam. I was too scared to write, too scared to keep a journal even. I was superstitious, and I thought, boy, I don't want that diary found on my body, full of all these sentimental, terrible, self-pitying thoughts. I thought, well, if I can just, keep my mouth shut and my brain shut in a way, I'll survive. But mostly it was fear. I was really terrified. When you're getting shot at, you tend to get afraid. And I wasn't thinking of myself as a writer then. I was thinking of myself as a scared 21-year-old kid. And I lived in a kind of a day-to-day sort of way, thinking I made it that day, there are only 200 days left. It wasn't until afterward that the enormity of the experience hit me. The disjunction between being in combat one day and the next day sitting in a big 727 jet with tweed seats and stewardesses returning from Vietnam, watching a movie, coming into Seattle at night and looking down at the McDonald's golden arches and applauding and cheering. The whole plane erupted. Even the most plastic kind of tinsel symbol of our culture at least had an emotional attachment to peace, quietude. There it is, and I'm back. And so when you're in a situation of daily stress and daily fear, it's hard to remember what peace is. There's a line in Cacciato that says, peace is shy, it doesn't brag about itself. We live our lives in Philadelphia or Boston or wherever, and it's as if, this is the way it is and always will be and always has been. It's daily routine, daily things, nice, bad. And in war, you forget how wonderful peace is.
How did you feel like a different person when you got home after being in the war?
I don't know. No, in some ways, no, I didn't. I wasn't traumatized. I don't dream about Vietnam even now. I don't have nightmares. I don't feel changed. In any kind of obvious sort of way. Some people, I suppose, were traumatized by Vietnam, and some veterans continue to suffer. For me, it was a subtler sort of thing. As I said, my career, the thing that's most important to my intellectual and emotional life, is writing, fiction. And I wouldn't have become a writer of fiction if it hadn't been for that experience. So I was changed in a great big way, yes. But in terms of my personality, no.
Can you read another excerpt
Sure.
for us from Going After Cacciato?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I want to kind of preface this one by saying that one of the key things about Vietnam was a sense of ignorance. I've talked about it a bit already. And this single paragraph gets at that. It's about a group of soldiers. They did not know even the simple things, a sense of victory or satisfaction or necessary sacrifice. They, the soldiers of Vietnam, did not know the feeling of taking a place and keeping it, securing a village and then raising the flag and calling it a victory. No sense of order or momentum. No front, no rear, no trenches laid out in neat parallels. No Patton rushing for the Rhine. No beachheads to storm and win and hold for the duration. They, the soldiers, did not have targets. They did not have a cause. They did not know if it was a war of ideology or economics or hegemony or spite. On a given day, they did not know where they were or how being there might influence larger outcomes. They did not know the names of most villages. They did not know which villages were critical. They did not know strategies. They did not know the terms of the war, its architecture, the rules of fair play. When they took prisoners, which was rare, they did not know the questions to ask, whether to release a suspect or beat on him. They did not know how to feel, whether when seeing a dead Vietnamese, to be happy or sad or relieved, whether in times of quiet, to be apprehensive or content, whether to engage the enemy or elude him, avoid him. They did not know how to feel when they saw villages burning, revenge, loss, peace of mind, anguish. They didn't know. They knew the old myths about Vietnam, tales passed down from old-timer to newcomer, but they did not know which stories to believe. Magic, mystery, ghosts, incense, whispers in the dark, strange tongues and strange smells, uncertainties never articulated in war stories, emotion squandered on ignorance. They did not know good from evil.
You have, in a way, tried in this book to capture not only what's different about Vietnam than from other wars, but just all those questions that you're asking there that, mm-hmm. that are usually passed over in war stories for concepts of bravery and valor
sure.
and for that push to get to the front lines and, mm-hmm. and not to get to
absolutely.
To the rear. I should think that anyone reading a book like yours would really be forced to say, is war worth fighting? Is any war worth fighting? Is a war like this going to ever accomplish anything? And will the people who leave it leave much more wounded, even if they don't carry physical wounds mm-hmm. from the war? But do you think that that your book or any book could ever?
Well, I do know this.
Help prevent war?
No, I mean I don't think so. I mean history is certainly against it. There have been some pretty wonderful books written, which can be taken as anti-war books. The Red Badge of Courage didn't prevent World War I, did it? Homer, who wrote about the Trojan Wars, one of the greatest artists of all time, didn't prevent a subsequent war. Nor did Shakespeare, who's one of his chief themes, was war and the consequences of war. And if history seems to be so... I'm not sure how to express this, but I mean, history history gives me no confidence that art can prevent war of any sort. I mean, if you look at Picasso's great, great kind of statement against the fascist Guernica painting, that didn't stop the next war, did it? I don't think the function of art, of literature, of painting, is political. I don't think its function is to accomplish political ends, but rather its function is to inform the human spirit and the human mind, to inform it not just in an intellectual sense, but in a spiritual sense, to give a feeling for what the consequences of war are, the consequences of war. You know, it's very easy when we talk about war to think in really grand kind of macro terms. You know, it's a terrible thing, or in cliches, it's an awful thing, war is hell. To be so abstract and so analytical when we talk about war, especially when it comes to politicians talking about it, the grand sacrifices we'll make, or the platitudes that are used by politicians. You know, it's a terrible, terrible suffering. We must make sacrifices. But what fiction does, what art does, is to focus on particulars, a single human being, to watch him die. And if we get to know if the art is good enough, if the novel is good enough, the story is good enough, and we feel in reading that story that a human being has perished or has suffered, or that a really nice guy has become a killer, a madman, or if we watch a village being annihilated and really watch it and see it blow up and the sense of being there, that's informing the spirit. It's informing the intellect as well. Now, it's not just art that does that. You know, barroom stories do it. You know, if you could just talk, and if your father tells you how it was in World War II or Korea, that it does it. So it's not just art that does it, but art's a big part of it. And it's up to the individual human being to make his political choices and his life choices based on everything he's read, everything he's seen, his whole life. And art's only part of that.
What kind of reactions have you gotten from your readers, from readers who read your book mostly from a literary point of view, whose special interest wasn't necessarily the war in Vietnam, and from maybe vets who read your book because they wanted to read specifically about your impressions of the war experience?
It's been really diverse. The reviews of Cacciato were splendid, and critically it was a success. Veterans have different responses to it. How do you have to? In a sense, there were as many Vietnam wars as there were soldiers in Vietnam. That we each of us had a different perspective on the war. We came to the war with different backgrounds. We saw different things. Our jobs were different. Some of us were foot soldiers, and our memories of the war differ radically from the memories of rear echelon soldiers. The bomber pilot's memory differs from that of mine. He was way up there looking down. He saw puffs of smoke. He heard the wind. His fear was of things, and his sights were of things that I didn't fear or see. And you see, therefore, you can't generalize. All you can do is tell a story, a particular story. Here is a story of a guy who walks away from Vietnam, and you can respond one of two ways. You can say either, well, I never saw anyone walk away from Vietnam. And you see, that's how many veterans respond. That's how veterans also respond to war movies. They say, look at that. You know, I never saw anything like that in Vietnam. That doesn't jibe with my experience. And what they're looking for is kind of a reflection of their experience, their particular experience. And they're not likely to see it. They're likely to feel a bit let down. But the purpose of a novel or a movie isn't to somehow capture how it was in a grand sense, but to capture one particular narrow kind of slant of here's how it was for one person.
And If I Die in a Combat Zone, your narrator writes, I grew out of one war and into another. Now, you were born what we call a war baby in 1946. Do you feel like your life is anyway intertwined in some inevitable fashion with war?
No, not really. I mean, it wasn't enough. That's one of the points of everything I've written is it wasn't inevitable I go to that war. In my first book, I write about how I almost didn't. I became very close to deserting, to going to Canada. I believe in freedom of will, I suppose. And if you believe in it, going to war isn't inevitable. You can say no. You can not do it. In my case, it was difficult, and I ended up not being able to do it. But I could have. And for a whole constellation or cluster of reasons, I felt myself being tugged toward the war, almost by physical gravity. I was sleepwalking into it. Half of me said, Tim, the war is wrong, and you know that. Don't go. And that same half was saying, you're afraid, too. Another reason not to go. But there's another side of me, which was I grew up in a small town. My father was a sailor in World War II. My mother was a wave. My town was conservative, a prairie town. And I felt a whole bunch of things. I didn't want to make my mom and dad stop loving me by running away, deserting. I didn't want to live in exile. I mean, I liked America. And I couldn't imagine a 21-year-old kid living in Sweden. What would I do? A sense of exile was awful. I also felt, I told myself, Tim, you're young, you're ignorant, you don't know very much. Maybe these guys are right. Maybe Rusk is right and Lyndon Johnson. You know, you aren't the smartest person in the world and you don't know what they know. So it was a battle, and I felt like a schizophrenic. And in the end, when it came time to decide whether to take a bus to Canada, which was only 90 miles away from where I was in training, or to get on a plane to Vietnam, I couldn't make up my mind, and my decision-making power seemed to click off somehow. And I remember just there I was on the plane.
If you knew what it was going to be like, do you think you would have just gone onto that bus?
Oh, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, I've got a really solid imagination. I knew myself. I knew how terrified I'd be. I knew how much I hated the Army already because I'd put up with it for basic training and then advanced infantry training. I knew I wasn't a soldierly kind of human being. I wasn't a born soldier. I was just the opposite. And I knew it would be terrible, and I knew I would feel awful, and I was afraid, you know, and yet I went anyway. You don't have to kill somebody to know how terrible it would feel doing it, because we dream about those sorts of things. You don't have to jump out of an airplane to know that you're going to be afraid, because we're human beings, we have imaginations.
I'd like to ask you about the book that you're writing now. Let me just reintroduce you first for our listeners who are just joining us. My guest is Tim O'Brien, who is a novelist, and his first three novels have been related to the Vietnam War. His most recent one is called Going After Cacciato, but he has a novel in progress now, and that's called The Nuclear Age. And earlier this morning, he gave a reading from it at Temple University. He's in Philadelphia as a guest lecturer at Temple University's Center City course. And what's the new book about, Tim?
In a way, it's radically different from anything I've done before, but in a way, it's precisely the same. The book is called The Nuclear Age, and it's about fear of apocalypse, fear of doom, doomsday. As I just finished saying, I dream, and I have an imagination, and one of the things I dream about is the bomb going off. When I was a kid, maybe 11 or 12 years old, I converted my ping pong table in the basement into a fallout shelter. All those Connell Rat alerts and tests of the emergency broadcast system and pictures of the bomb in Life magazine, all those images that swirled around in the 50s and early 60s of, you know, maybe this is going to happen. It was new to us then. We were afraid back then. If any of the listeners to this program remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, you remember the utter terror, psychological terror of the bomb. Well, it's gone now, I think, anyway. The thing that scares me most is that I'm not scared anymore. I'm not as scared, as afraid as I used to be. Now, the novel begins, the new one, with this kid building his ping pong table fallout shelter. And the terms of the new book is comedy. It's a funny story. It has cheerleaders in it, and it has, for example, the heroine of the novel is a very pretty college cheerleader, and a very athletic cheerleader at that, a good one. She's talented. She loves cheerleading. She believes in cheerleading. Yet she has a fatal little flaw that on her lip there's a herpes virus, a cold sore that won't go away. It gets bigger and bigger, and it mars her beauty. So instead of cheerleading at the football games, she's made a second stringer, despite her talent, and she's consigned to doing her cheerleading at things like archery matches. Well, archery isn't big at this college. It's not a very big sport. and she desperately wants to be a first stringer. And so she does some pretty outlandish things to make the first string. At each archery match, she begins by shaving her legs in public. And pretty soon, because she's a good cheerleader too, pretty soon people begin coming to the archery matches to look at this girl, and she's sexy and she's gutsy. And by not much later, archery becomes the biggest sport on campus. Everybody's going to archery matches. Nobody's going to the football games. The story, the novel, follows her life from cheerleading to her becoming radicalized in the late 60s to becoming eventually a terrorist, an anti-bomb terrorist. She too is afraid of the possibility of nuclear war, and to do something about it begins stealing bombs, doing acts of terrorism in the hope that somehow these will alert people to it. That's just one character in a book that's full of characters. But the theme, nonetheless, is much related to what I've done in the past, fear. What does it mean to be brave? What kinds of acts are brave? Is it brave to just forget the bomb and live a life? Or is it brave to try to do something about it? How do you behave? It's political in a way. In a way, it's very psychological and personal. Why aren't we afraid of the bomb anymore? You know, one of the things I don't understand in my old age of 34 now, I just don't understand is why all the attention to power plants? The Clamshell Alliance up in New England fighting Seabrook, a power plant. Well, sure, they may be dangerous. Sure, maybe we should stop them, maybe. But on a scale of danger, of peril, at least nuclear power plants are designed to be safe, aren't they? I mean, they work it into the system. They try to. But bombs aren't. Bombs are designed for just precisely the opposite. That is, to be unsafe, to be dangerous, to kill. What happened to our priorities? Why are we out demonstrating against power plants when there's the threat of the bomb is so much greater? I don't get it. I don't understand it.
Of course, you're a consumer of the product of the power plant. You don't consume what the bombs do. There's a certain sense of control. I think people feel that. Mm-hmm. That they have the possibility of exerting over nuclear power, whereas nuclear weapons seem so much controlled by other people, by the leaders of the country, and you can't boycott them the way you can form a picket line around the nuclear power plant.
Well, no, but if you say that, then you're kind of saying, well, we can't control the most important, to me at least, the most important single danger.
Isn't this the kind of absurdity we've gotten into, though? You're like, which kind of nuclear hazard is worse. And mm-hmm. they're both capable of doing incredible damage, mm-hmm. right? And well, it's a kind of like really strange bond.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that the danger is substantially greater with bombs than with power plant. I don't mean just little. I mean substantially different. One power plant could go. But if one bomb goes, the rest are going to go, probably. Escalation. Almost all the scenarios that are written about nuclear war are like this. The Russians, let's say, decide in a time of great crisis, maybe a conventional war has broken out, that we'll lob a bomb into the Gulf of Mexico just to show we can do it. And we'll respond by lobbing one into one of their gulfs, let's say. And that'll be countered by, it'll go up and up. Herbert Kahn is a big strategist in this. Thomas Schelling at Harvard writes a lot about it. And almost all of the thinkers about how nuclear war would occur if it were to occur agree at least on one thing, that it'll occur in stages, one stage causing the next, causing the next, causing the next. Whereas with power plants, it doesn't work that way. One can go. It'll be a catastrophe, maybe terrible, but at least it'll be controlled. It won't be a causal link causing the next one to go off. You see the big difference? That's one of many differences.
You seem to think, Tim, that fear of nuclear catastrophe has subsided. I've been feeling it just soaring back
really?
Up again.
I hope so.
Just even judging on the number of programs I've been hearing about mm-hmm. nuclear power, I just feel, nuclear yeah. weapons, I mean, I just feel a new fear mm-hmm. of...
I hope so. I mean, in a way, I think you're right. I mean, there was a program, for example, on PBS not too long ago called Nuclear Nightmares, which did... Well, its subject was just what I was mentioning, scenarios of how it might happen. In a way, you're maybe right, but it's not... At least in my opinion, I mean, I took no polls or anything. It just feels, as in, you know, a kind of artsy, craftsy word, it feels that the fear isn't great enough. It certainly hasn't reached the pitch, say, of the crisis of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It hasn't reached that level. And what scares me is that it may take something like that to rekindle the fear. Now, one thing art can do, at least, what a novel can do is by making these people I'm making real, by making them seem funny and wonderful and you love the characters, and by making their obsessions seem real, that when you're reading my book, you're laughing and you're having fun and you're excited and it's dramatic. And just then, at least for that time, you're alive to the possibilities. You're alive to it. And the feeling is there. It's not just rational. It's not just kind of cocktail talk. You're living somebody's life, and the person whose life you're living in my book is someone who is scared to death and is doing some outlandish things about his fear, her fear. And that's what art can do. It can enliven us through drama. It can beguile us into loving the characters, and then once you're dragged into the story, you know, and you're having fun, then slowly but surely, I hope to God, the book will make you think. It'll make you afraid. It'll make you wonder, why haven't I been paying attention to this? In a way that straight nonfiction can't do it. That's why I'm a fiction writer, is you can cast spells and make people love the book and be into the book in an imaginative sort of way. You're engaged in it because you're looking at things over a human being's shoulder and through human eyes. And that's not abstract analysis, and it's not scholarly descriptions of how nuclear war might break out. All that stuff sounds abstract. You know, one of the things that most intrigues me about the writing of fiction is that a certain kind of magic happens. When I read books I love, for just that hour or two or four that it takes me to read that book, I'm not me anymore. I'm not Tim O'Brien. I'm the person whose life I'm living in the book. And it's that technique that I hope I can use to maybe, you know, stir up some more concerns, my passions and fears and obsessions. I'm going to make them real for others.
Well, Tim, I can't think of a better note to end on, and anyways, we are out of time. It's really been so interesting to...
I've had fun.
...listen to you. Thanks so much for coming. I really
Good.
Appreciate it. I've been speaking with Tim O'Brien, and he's a novelist. We've been talking about his writing and also talking about his war experience. His first three books dealt in one way or another with his experience as a soldier in Vietnam. His most recent book is called Going After Cacciato. That was published in 1978. It won a National Book Award at that time. The book that he is in the process of writing now, which we were just talking about, is called The Nuclear Age. Do you have any idea when that's going to be published?
I'm about a quarter of the way through it, so I would reckon probably in 82, but a piece of it appeared in last month's Esquire, the ping pong table chapter, so you can take a look at the August Esquire and get a sneak preview.
Good. Well, Tim, thanks again, and I hope you have a good stay in
Thanks
Philadelphia.
Thanks for having me.
Tim is a guest lecturing at a Temple University Center City English course.